Hello, welcome to Earthwatch, Radio Canada International's weekly program on science, nature, and the environment. On today's show, a research team in Eastern Canada is hoping to protect endangered whales in the North Atlantic. Herds of caribou in the northwestern part of the country could be in danger due to oil and gas exploration. We'll have a report on a group of First Nations Aboriginals who are traveling to towns in the north to save the caribou and their traditional way of life. A plan to build a natural gas-fired power plant in the American state of Washington is causing concern for the air quality on the Canadian side of the border. And we'll hear from a biotechnology conference held this week in Montreal. It is looking into the possibility of developing drugs that can be tailor-made to your own DNA. I'm David Blair, and this is Earthwatch. The right whale is one of Canada's most endangered species. Scientists report that there are less than 350 whales left in the North Atlantic. They also estimate that the right whale could become extinct within the next 200 years because the mammal's population isn't reproducing fast enough to maintain the species. One of the main reasons there are fewer right whales is because of collisions they've had with ships in the Bay of Fundy on the eastern coast of Canada. Now a Nova Scotia scientific research team is hoping to reverse this trend. They want to develop a tracking system that would warn ships of the whale's presence in the water. Lynn Francoise Pelletier explains.
You'll find the Bay of Fundy between the maritime provinces of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. The bay is famous worldwide for its record tides that reach more than 14 meters high. It's also home to rich marine life and to endangered species like the North Atlantic right whales. Each year, the right whales leave the warm waters off the coast of Florida to migrate to their feeding grounds in the Bay of Fundy. Josie Michaud, a PhD student at Dalhousie University, says the whales spend part of the summer and early fall in the bay feeding on a small crustacean.
Right whales feed not only on copepods, but feed mainly on one species of copepod and one stage. The copepod they're feeding on are really fat. They're filled with lipids. So the whales are concentrating their effort on that type of food, so it's really specific.
But the right whale's summer habitat intersects directly with international shipping lanes to ports in the United States and Canada. Fishing nets are also deployed along the whale's course. In the past 10 years, several whales have been killed by at least four ship strikes and numerous fishnet entanglements. A Nova Scotia scientific research team from the Department of Oceanography at Dalhousie University and from the Defense Research Establishment Atlantic, a special agency within Canada's National Defense, is hoping to reverse that trend. The team used underwater microphones to capture the sounds made by whales and to determine their location. Alec Hay is an acoustical oceanography specialist at Dalhousie University.
Well, it's been quite interesting. The whales make quite a range of sounds, but the major result that's quite exciting is that there's just that the whales make sounds all the time. Well, they're quiet for periods of time, but they are very talkative, and that's quite encouraging. So we are able to now develop an intelligent system that will detect their sounds automatically and do the location automatically, at least in principle.
Angela van der Laan is doing a science and technology internship with the research team. One of her jobs is to identify the right whale's vocalization.
We basically picked up three different sounds types, I would say. Classifying them as gunshots, which are sound like a gun being fired, and then we've got some low frequency moans that tend to have an upsweep in them, and they kind of sound like a whoomph. They go whoomph like that, and then the trumpety ones.
She also calculates distribution probabilities of the whales within the Bay of Fundy. Chris Taggart, an associate professor of oceanography at the university, explains why this information is important.
If we know the pattern of the distribution of the animals and how that pattern changes seasonally and how that pattern changes spatially and how that pattern changes with things like the tides, then we have information that will allow us to reduce the probability of entanglement with gear by trying to keep whales and gear independently of each other, but without compromising the fishing practices.
Dalhousie's University's Alex Hay believes the shipping industry would also benefit from a permanent whale tracking system in the Bay of Fundy.
What we would hope to be able to do would be to deploy an array of underwater microphones, we call them hydrophones, along the shipping lane. And if a whale makes a noise, and these noises that they make tend to be a quite brief duration, in the order of a second or so, then that sound will arrive at these different hydrophones at different times. And from those time differences, we can determine the location of the whale that made the sound. If we our real-time recognition and data processing system works effectively, then we'll be able to transmit that position to St. John, which will be able to redirect shipping traffic to avoid the whale in that location.
But the scientific team will have to do a lot more research on right whales before they're able to install a permanent warning system in the Bay of Fundy. Mario Lorinoli, a master's student involved in the acoustics research project, says information on the endangered species is scarce.
We don't know enough about their biology and reproduction to know if, even if we reduce the number of deaths from ships, they may not still may not recover. We don't know that yet, and we're not going to know that in our lifetime. But all this information is going to be useful because there's still a lot of other whales out there, and you know, the same similar things could happen with other species as well. And that's what science is all about. It's all about learning things to apply towards other things.
Again, Françoise Pelletier, Radio Canada International, Halifax.
There are about 7,500 people who rely on the porcupine caribou herd for food and clothing in Canada's Northern Territories. The Gwich'in First Nations Aboriginals say that both the herd and their own futures are at risk. The caribou's habitat is under threat of oil and gas development because there's an estimated 3 billion barrels of oil underground. Now the Gwich'in are traveling to various communities to raise awareness about the importance of the herd to their way of life. Stacey Mugagi has the story.
I don't know what kind of boat we're going to go by.
Neil Collins is in a van heading to a Clavix boat launch. He's going to be traveling by boat to Fort McPherson on this cold, wet morning. Fort McPherson is the last community in the Northwest Territories before entering the Yukon. Seven other people are going with Collins. They will be traveling by boat first, then by plane and truck until they reach Arctic Village, the closest community to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. They're loading the boat, fastening life jackets with great speed to get out of the pounding rain. They get into the boat and they take off down the Peel River. There's smiles on all of the faces despite the cramped quarters and the heavy rain. Norma Cassie from Old Crow in the Yukon is tucked inside the boat. She has spent the last 15 years of her life trying to protect the caribou. Cassie says the race is on. United States President Bill Clinton's term is up this fall, and the Gwich'in Nation want him to declare the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge a national monument. That would mean no oil and gas development could ever take place on Alaska's coastal plain. Cassie has traveled all of Canada, the United States, and overseas, trying to convince people that the future of the caribou is also the future of the Gwich'in.
This means our whole way of life depends on what's going to take place in the United States, a government that's way far away from us up here, and to get that message there.
Wally McPherson from Iqaluit is one person who is taking that message to Alaska. He says the Gwich'in call themselves caribou people. They rely on the caribou for food and clothing. McPherson worked with oil exploration companies 20 years ago in the Mackenzie Delta.
This track is really important to me. The way people talk about it, they don't want this drilling rigs on to start drilling. And I've been on the oil rigs for many years. I know what will happen if they have a blowout. I exactly know what will happen. Demolish that land.
Some people say oil exploration is one of the worst things that could happen to the area. Bob Urquhart is a member of the Porcupine Caribou Management Board based in Whitehorse.
You could drop a nuclear weapon there. Other than that, this would be it.
Urquhart studied the porcupine caribou herd for years. This was the worst year in recorded history for the number of calves born in the refuge. Urquhart fears those numbers will continue to drop, especially if that area is open to development.
The infrastructure of an oil field is massive, and even though there's talk about reducing that, they reduce the size of the drill pads and the angle drill, etc., oil fields tend to grow and grow and grow. And what would start off as, maybe a small development will just continually expand. And the caribou just can't tolerate anything like that because it's the most sensitive time of year. It's like taking a ghetto blaster playing rock music into the nursery of your home. Might be okay down in the basement, but not there.
Gladys Nitro is Gwich'in. She says the key to permanent protection of the caribou calving grounds lies in reaching the American public.
When they hear the message of the Gwich'in cry for saving the birthing grounds, it seems that once the average American public understand that it is federal land, that they feel that they have a voice, they feel that they can make a difference, that's been our main support.
That's the support the Gwich'in will need to convince U.S. President Clinton to close the calving grounds to development forever. Some people doubt Clinton will come through for the Gwich'in, but the eight people at the start of their journey to the calving grounds are confident he will. Once they reach Arctic Village, a group of Gwich'in elders will enter the calving grounds, bless the area, and offer thanks to a land that has provided food and clothing for them for thousands of years. In Iqaluit, I'm Stacy McGaggy.
Residents of the western province of British Columbia are opposed to a plan by an American company from Washington State to build a natural gas-fired power plant less than a kilometer from the international border. But before the company gets the go-ahead, scientists from Canada and the United States will have to look at the impact the plant will have on the environment on both sides of the international border. Lauren Curry reports.
We gather here as people who are concerned about the air we breathe.
The air quality in British Columbia's Lower Fraser Valley is the third worst in Canada. Now, an American company, Sumas Energy 2, wants to build a 660-megawatt natural gas-fired power plant. And the people in this area say the power plant, in the nearby American border town of Sumas, would make a bad air situation even worse. Environmental activist David Cadman says the fact that the pollution would end up in Canada is particularly objectionable because the electricity is not even meant for this area.
You don't put a large gas generating facility to supply a California market, and that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about a BC market. BC is a net exporter of hydroelectricity. Washington State is a net exporter of hydroelectricity. We're talking about a supplying a California market from this area. And quite frankly, this facility could not be sited in California because of its pollution emissions. California's got the highest standards on the continent. We have said in British Columbia that we want to follow those standards.
Before being able to build the plant, the company will need to get an environmental permit from the state of Washington. As part of the process, U.S. authorities, along with Canadian federal and British Columbia provincial scientists, undertook a review of the impact emissions from the proposed plant would have on the airshed of the Lower Fraser Valley. According to the scientists responsible for monitoring air quality in the area, the power plant would add only a small amount of fine particulate matter, the substances considered most dangerous for human health, to the region's air. Its biggest impact would be greenhouse gases. The estimates are that the plant would add 2.2 million tons of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere annually. But regardless of the numbers, opponents of the power plant say in an area where air quality is already a serious concern, adding any pollution is a bad idea. In the last few months, both the provincial government and Canada's Federal Minister of the Environment, David Anderson, have come out against the project. But Anderson says if he's to convince Washington State to turn down the Sumas Energy application, British Columbia will have to give some sign it's prepared to address the bad air in the Lower Fraser Valley.
Unless you go to Americans with a clear indication that you're willing to do in Canada what you're asking them to do in the States, they tend not to pay much attention. And what I am telling you is that the basic problem of air pollution in the Fraser Valley is basically from communities to the west, namely, essentially, Vancouver. So let's try and make sure we show that we're willing to improve air quality instead of simply saying to Americans, it's only when you are proposing something that we bother to do anything about air quality.
However, Anderson's position does not impress many environmental groups involved in the fight against the Sumas power plant. They say by not being categorical in his opposition and criticizing British Columbia, the minister is undermining the work being done on the Canadian side of the border against the project. Tim Howard is with the Sierra Legal Defense Fund.
The proponent of the project is walking around the United States saying that Canada's position is not clear, and that's for one reason only. It's because our federal minister of environment is undercutting the work of all those other groups and governments by not coming out strongly against this proposal and working against it. I'm concerned that Minister Anderson has been engaged in negotiations with the United States about air quality in eastern Canada. And frankly, I'm concerned that he's selling the residents of the Lower Fraser Valley down the river so that he can protect his negotiations back east.
In the end, it will be up to the governor of the state of Washington to decide whether the plant goes ahead. But if Canadian authorities want to, they could complicate matters. The Sumas Energy Plan calls for the natural gas that will power the plant to come from Canada. That means the company selling the gas will need to obtain an export permit to send the fuel south. As well, the plant would be located much closer to the Canadian electric power grid than to the U.S. one. So Sumas Energy is hoping to run the electricity it will generate at the plant back into Canada to hook up to the North American power grid. To do that, it will need a permit from Canada's National Energy Board. And before the board can grant that permit, it will have to hold public hearings. Lauren Curry, Radio Canada International, Vancouver.
800 biotechnology experts from 7 countries gathered in Montreal this week to discuss the future of this growing field. Biotechnology has made a quantum leap in the past few years thanks to computer science. And as a result of spectacular advances in genomics, biotechnology now has the potential to make major genetic modifications to our own species and provide cures for otherwise incurable diseases. Martin Gauthier has covered the conference here in Montreal this past week, and he joins me here in our Montreal studio. Hello, Martin.
Hello, David.
Martin, everyone in the world has a unique set of DNA. That's their genetic code. And there's been a lot of talk about being able to tailor-make drugs for patients based on their specific needs and DNA. How close do these experts think we are to having personalized medicine?
Well, having therapeutic drugs based on personalized DNA has been on everyone's mind since scientists announced this summer they had completed a draft sequencing in the human genome.
Like the human genome is the sequence of all human genes.
It's exactly what we call now the book of life mm-hmm. for the human being. According to the Director General of the Biotechnology Research Institute in Montreal, Michel Desrochers, personalized drugs are not likely to be on the market soon, but that does not mean we will not benefit from present scientific progress.
I'd say we're already in the area of diagnostics using genomics-based information. This is going to come out fairly soon. In terms of therapeutics, it may take a little bit longer. The information we have in hand is so massive, and the interactions between genes are not that straightforward. We'll need a lot of bioinformatics. We will need a lot of physiology, a lot of validation, and so on. It may take a little while. Not long ago, some people had said that it would be impossible to sequence a human genome. Then it was supposed to be sequenced around 2010, then 2003. And it was sequenced before that. So it may come earlier, but let's not underestimate the difficulties and the hurdles we have to go through because it is a very complex area.
Okay, Martin, Dr. Desrochers spoke of bioinformatics. What's that?
Yes, this is one of the hurdles he just mentioned. The world presently lacks experts to efficiently decipher all the information computers generate from the study of genes. You see, the sequencing of the human genome implies you have information of 100,000 genes, some 3 billion bits of DNA or nucleotides. Mm-hmm. And you have to bear in mind that there are variations in these genes from one human being to another.
Very difficult to decipher, I guess.
Exactly. It's like a satellite being able to produce detailed maps of streets, of cities in the world. You can look deep down into the fabric of life, but someone has to be able to make sense of these biomaps so as to use them to produce the proper medication that purpose to be without side effects. Thus, a promising new field is emerging, bioinformatics, a merge between biotechnology and computer science. Stefan Hurst is the manager of scientific affairs and training for the Canadian Genetic Disease Network. He has taken the bull by the horn, so to speak.
My own group has been developing a way of taking our researchers or getting our graduate students to go back into the classroom and learn new skills in computer science. We're also taking the similar approach the other way, trying to encourage computer scientists who are interested in biology to learn more about biology, and in that way develop a group of people who we call bioinformaticians, who really are conversant with the jargon of both sides.
These new advances in biotechnology will likely be discussed at the Pacific Rim Biotechnology Conference that will run from November 12th to November 16th in Vancouver.
Well, I think the idea of personalized drugs based on everyone's individual DNA, it's a pretty interesting topic, and we'll definitely be watching the scientific developments that come out of that conference in November. Thank you for this, Martin.
Goodbye, David.
Bye-bye. Martin Gauthier, Radio Canada International's correspondent, covering the biotechnology conference this past week in Montreal. And that will bring us right to the end of Earthwatch for this week on Radio Canada International. My thanks to Lynn-Françoise Pelletier, Lauren Curry, Martin Gauthier, Michel Mercure, and Alain Collin. I'm David Blair.